This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
My name is Murray Riches. I'm a communications student at Waikato University. Just finished my fourth year of a Bachelor of Communications Studies and heading into Masters next year, which I'm looking forward to.
Where do you come from, Murray?
I grew up in Taumarunui, which is a small town near Mount Ruapehu National Park sort of area, but currently live in Drury because my partner works in Auckland, so it's kind of halfway between Hamilton and Auckland. So.
What was it like growing up in Taumarunui?
Pretty isolated, rural, small town sort of situation. Queerness or, gay role models were completely invisible and absent, I think, so, yeah.
When did you realise that you may be gay?
It's always a really interesting question because I think in hindsight, when you look back and think, oh wow, you kind of actually knew from a long time earlier, but I didn't really acknowledge it or deal with it at all until I left home at 17 and moved to Pahiatua of all places, which is not much bigger, but it was a different town, so that was important, and a new social group and new connections and things, and then I was able to kind of explore my sexuality and things like that.
So in Taumarunui, how was gay or queerness seen? Did you have any idea about gayness or queerness when you were growing up?
It was interesting. We were just talking briefly about the use of the word gay, and I think very much growing up in Taumarunui, the only thing I knew about being gay was that it was a horrible, negative, kind of dirty thing and something you certainly didn't want to be, because the only kind of association I had with that word and that idea was that really negative kind of insult put down sort of thing. So yeah, so definitely nothing positive to be associated with gayness at all.
Were you aware of any queer people in Taumarunui?
No, I wasn't at the time, and it's only looking back now that I realised that I was surrounded by, obviously there were other, I wasn't the only gay in the village, there were heaps of other queer people around town, but they were completely invisible and absent, I think, to me at the time, from that perspective. But then, yeah, looking back, I can see that they were actually there. And I'm frustrated that they were kind of absent, because they would have been really important and helpful role models to me, I think. So,
how do you think the town would have handled it if people were, like, more openly out?
I think there would have been a lot of sort of, just kind of eye-rolling kind of chat about, that kind of guy over there, sort of, the town spectacle or whatever, I think. Yeah, I don't know. But in saying that, since coming out and heading back to Taumarunui, not living there permanently, but just being back there, I haven't actually encountered that much prejudice, really, I think. I think sometimes being silent is more silencing than just, if you just come out and you're just out in a town like that, it's actually not that big a deal, but it's just kind of that kind of structure of silence that keeps people quiet anyway. So, yeah, if that makes sense.
Did you find growing up that you also had to participate in, kind of like gay humour and calling people gay and stuff?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's sort of a really funny masculine culture which spends a lot of time talking about gayness and joking about gayness, and kind of that high school boys thing of like all the gay jokes and the kind of gay situations and things, and like, it's quite bizarre that there's like a really strong focus on gayness, and yeah, but in a really negative sense, I think. Yeah.
So you moved to a new town, and then what happened?
So I moved to a new town, Pahetua, which, yeah, like I said, is just another small town, but just being in a social group where I was spending time with people who were a lot older than me, and they were people that I didn't have already sort of those relationships with, so it was sort of a fresh start, new relationships to be built and that sort of thing, and so I was able to sort of engage with them on a different level, and I actually, one of my friends there introduced me, she kind of had a thought that I might be gay, so she introduced me to an older gay man who lived in the town, and we just became really good friends, and he was sort of like a massive role model to me, I suppose. And yeah, we just got on really well, and he showed me I don't know, you know, just introduced me to the idea of you know, being part of gay culture and just not having to be heterosexual, I suppose. So yeah,
what was that like, kind of discovering that kind of other culture?
I really loved it. I kind of, as soon as I found it, I was just kind of in love with it. It was just so different to anything I'd experienced before, I think, and just, yeah, really kind of liberating and exciting, I think, and kind of homely, I don't know, like, yeah, just kind of discovering it was kind of like, yeah, I don't know, there's something quite kind of safe and homely about being in gay culture. I kind of found that, yeah, kind of fitted in.
Is this one of the reasons which prompted you into your research?
Yeah, I suppose so. Just that awareness that, like, there are lots of people that grow up in small towns like me where queerness is silent and absent, I suppose. And yeah, and that that is a big problem. Yeah, definitely.
Tell me about the research project.
Yeah, okay. Well, it kind of started by just a conversation with a lecturer of mine who happened to be a gay man as well. We talked about wanting to do something like this, and he got in touch with Kevin Haig about maybe something that he might be interested in doing. And he said, he was like, yeah, wonderful. I've actually been thinking about the same sort of things. And the fact that, as he put it, that being an out gay man in New Zealand is not really that difficult for him in his experience. Like, it's something that's it's much better than it was, you know, 20 years ago. But for young people, it's actually still really challenging. So so we need to look at how we can make that better. So that's how it kind of started out. And the name, which is kind of sounds a bit clumsy if there's no context to it, how do we make it better, sort of came out of that idea that you'll remember the It Gets Better project that went around, started in America, I think. And so the idea was, well, yeah, it does get better for most queer people, but how do we actually make it better now? Like, how do we change the culture for young people that it's just not so hard, because all the statistics and the Youth 07 statistics and things like that all point to the fact that it's pretty tough for young people to be queer. Yeah.
What are the statistics now in terms of things like suicide and bullying and violence?
The Youth 07 statistics, which are probably the best ones currently in New Zealand, suggested that queer youth are, I think it's 6 times more likely to commit suicide than their heterosexual peers, and things like mental illness and substance abuse and risky sexual behaviour are all a lot higher than their heterosexual peers. And so definitely much higher risk factors for queer young people.
What year did you start the research?
Started it at the start of 2011, I think, so the start of last year.
And what did it involve?
It was basically, well, it was sort of a, it started out as being an academic sort of project, started out with a literature review type thing, looking at what other countries are doing and their experiences of how to improve the situation and things like that, and also the statistics in New Zealand and how queer youth are faring in New Zealand. But then the major part was really to talk to community activists and community youth workers, because we kind of felt that there are a lot of people in New Zealand doing really amazing things with young people, and like, for example, the QSA network that's recently been established, and Rainbow Youth, and all these people that are really really doing wonderful things, and it would be really great to talk to them, because they're the people that really know what's going on and what we need, and to be able to kind of bridge that gap between their kind of grassroots wisdom and sort of policy making and that sort of thing, and sort of making those sort of changes at that level as well. So yeah, so the major part was to really to talk to them, so 22 people, and just basically interview them and to ask them about what the major problems they thought were facing queer youth, and pretty much how we can improve the situation, what needs to be done.
Were these face-to-face interviews?
Yes, mostly face-to-face interviews, yeah.
And was that across the country?
Yeah, yeah. It was people from Auckland, Hamilton, Wellington, Dunedin, Christchurch and Nelson. So yeah, tried to get a good spread of the country and also a good spread in terms of age range and what people are doing within the community. So talking to, like, for example, student activists as well as people who had been involved with the community for a long, long time, as well as MPs and people like that. So, yeah.
Had you ever done a project before where you had gone and talked to such a variety of people?
No, never. No, no. It was an amazing experience. Actually, I really, really enjoyed it. Just the chance to talk to people with, like, such wisdom and such passion for what they were doing was, yeah, it's very cool. But no.
And had you ever been involved in such a kind of queer project before?
No, I hadn't actually. Something I kind of talk about a little bit in the report is this kind of, it's what I call it the discourse of silence, where there's this idea that, like, good queer people or good gays don't really talk about being gay that much. Like, it's kind of, to be a good gay, you kind of, you know, like a good gay, and as in sort of in speech marks, good, like, you fit into heterosexual society and you kind of, you, like, sort of pass, you know, like, so there's this idea that it's okay to be gay, but just kind of don't flaunt your sexuality, don't push your gayness onto anybody else. And so that's certainly my experience, especially in sort of more rural centres and things like that, that, yeah, you're okay to be a gay as long as you're sort of, you straighten up and you carry on like the rest of us kind of thing. And you, yeah. Yeah, so when I first started talking about doing this project, my first kind of gut reaction was kind of, oh, I'd much rather talk about poverty or environmental issues or something that, you know, wasn't so personal for me, because there's kind of that idea that you don't really want to talk about being gay or queerness at all. So really doing this project was almost like a kind of second coming out for me, I think. Like, it... it totally changed my perspective on queer issues and just kind of really threw me into queer activism in a way that I was, like, I just didn't want to engage with before, I think. So, yeah, it was very cool. I loved it.
Did doing those face-to-face interviews kind of change you in any other way, kind of like personally, in terms of how you react to people or your level of acceptance or things like that?
Yeah, I think it was hugely educational for me too. And also, not just doing those interviews, but as part of the project, I got to go along to some of these queer youth hui's that QSA Network is doing. But the first one I went to was Kazam, which was run by Rainbow Youth in Auckland. And it was completely an experience of queerness that just I hadn't experienced at all before. Like, I think there's a really strong gay culture, which I've been a part of, which is sort of that, it's sort of kind of celebrates straight acting, sort of gay men, sort of, and it's almost, it's not really what I would call queer culture, it's gay culture sort of thing, whereas this Kazam Hui was sort of my first experience of queer culture, which is much more fluid in terms of the way gender and sexuality is looked at, and that just kind of really just blew me away. I was just really amazed by these young people that talk about gender and sexuality in just, like, such a fluid way, and just a really accepting and open, and kind of, it's kind of just natural for them, this kind of fluidness to it. So, yeah, so, yeah, very educational for me, yeah.
You mentioned coming out, and I'm wondering, how did your family respond when you're doing such a queer project, and how did they respond to you, I suppose, initially, you know, in terms of coming out, and then in terms of, like, just being out there with this kind of project?
I suppose initially coming out, like anyone, I suppose, there's kind of that initial kind of shock and challenge, and and probably I had a lot of anxiety. My parents are Anglican ministers, so they sort of have a lot of kind of respect in the small town community, and so I was quite concerned about sort of the impact that would have on them and the way people might respond to them is more than how they might respond to me, I think. So that was quite challenging, but I think doing this project has probably been quite a learning experience for them too, because I've been able to kind of share all these insights that I've gained with them. And so my mum's become like the biggest sort of, you know, queer as folk, the P flag mum. She's kind of a little bit like that, Debbie, yeah. And so she's all sort of raving and queer and, yeah, activist now, which is really cool. So, yeah. She actually just recently came out in the newspaper in all her, because she's an archdeacon in Taranaki now, in all her sort of robes in support of gay marriage, and sort of saying that she couldn't wait for the church to marry same-sex couples, and got a bit of flack for it, but I was real proud that she came out and did that. So, yeah, so they're pretty supportive.
When you see that in the newspaper, what do you think? How do you feel?
I think it's really cool because something that I kind of really tried to emphasize and something that I really learned when doing this project was the power of silence and the power of invisibility and how marginalizing that is. And like my experience of growing up and actually being surrounded by queer people but not seeing them is, I think, probably one of the most marginalizing things, I think. So something that I want to keep kind of pushing is that we have to keep being really visible and keep making statements and stuff. So, yeah, so for her to come out and like make a public statement and to be really visible, I think is really good. And yeah, and I'm really frustrated that I think my experience of the church is that a lot of people are really supportive, but they don't say anything. And so their silence is part of the problem, I think. So, yeah, so it's really important that she comes out and says stuff. So, yeah.
How long did the research take?
It took about, well, we wanted to finish it for Hamilton Pride, which was in September of 2011, so we started at the start of the year, so it's about 9 months, I suppose. Yeah, just working part-time. I did it as a university paper, so yeah, through the year.
And what were the kind of key learnings that you got from the research?
We came up with a sort of, it's probably about 20 recommendations, which are kind of policy recommendations as well as kind of need for activism and visibility from within the community as well. And so so there's a few different things, like, for example, we talked about the need for error reporting to be much more specific and much more actually doing something, not just kind of this tokenistic. At the moment, there's a sort of a tick box exercise where schools have to say that they have policies to prevent bullying, including homophobic bullying, but all it really is kind of a check the box and you pass kind of thing. And so I'm suspicious that there isn't a lot of real genuine engagement with homophobic bullying from a lot of schools. And so that's something that I think really needs to be pushed as kind of a policy thing.
Was that something in your interviews with the support people in terms of, you know, was homophobic bullying quite prevalent?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was also the idea of bullying was quite big in the media at the time when this was going through last year. And there was a lot of frustration that people were talking about bullying, but just talking about bullying and not talking about homophobic bullying, which is kind of quite separate and quite significant and probably actually much more damaging and actually probably much more present than just non-homophobic bullying, I think. Yeah. Something else that people really talked about is the need to keep doing those visible celebrations and things like the Big Gay Out, and they're also talking about bringing back the Hero Parade in Auckland, which is really cool to see and really exciting, just because those sorts of things, they're really nice for the queer community to sort of all rally together and support each other, but they're also really important in terms of the media visibility that they get, because, like, for example, the 14-year-old boy growing up in Tobaranui that doesn't have any gay role models but can turn on the 6 o'clock news and see all these beautiful queer people and just kind of have this idea that, oh, there's this community out there which one day I just might find or might run into. And so, yeah, just that visibility, I think, is really important, and so keep pursuing that. It's great.
But I guess that also leads on to trying to, I guess, influence the media so they don't necessarily just portray stereotypes.
Yeah.
That actually they portray the breadth of the queer community.
Yeah, yeah. And that was another concern that people raised, is that when you have just hero parades and things like that, that the only images that get portrayed in the media are sort of these really hypersexualized kind of, just specific queer identities that not everybody, like some people certainly do want to identify with those identities, but not everybody. So that is, yeah, definitely a concern, that how do you get visibility that is kind of genuine and reflective of the queer community is a challenge. Something that I kind of talk about a little bit in the report, and something I'd quite like to do, well, to think about developing, is the idea of like a toolkit for media engagement for queer activists and queer communities and that sort of thing, or even like a spreadsheet of sort of go-to people in the queer community who can speak to media outlets and things like that, and just kind of keep engaging with the media and keep getting that positive involvement and that kind of accurate representation and things like that. So just kind of putting the steps in place so that we have all these really great people who would be fantastic role models, but just kind of putting the steps in place so that they can be talking to the media in a positive way, I think would be something that's quite helpful in terms of raising that visibility. So, yeah.
Did any of your findings surprise you?
I think from the very beginning they probably all did. Like, I think even just realizing the statistics around queer suicide and things like that, I think, yeah, the whole lot just really, I think I went into it really just a really ignorant white middle class gay man, you know, and just so the whole lot was just really educational and surprising to me, I think.
You mentioned earlier that the initial parts of the research were to look overseas and to see what other countries are doing and what they're up to. Mm-hmm. How does New Zealand compare to countries overseas?
I think every different country is sort of has really good things and really negative things, and so it'd be hard to sort of rank them, I'd say. But certainly Scandinavian countries seem to have be further ahead, I think. In my own view, that they have better kind of education systems and things like that about talking about gender and sexuality in schools, which is much less kind of heteronormative, which is very much the case in New Zealand. That our education system is very kind of heteronormative and sort of masculine as well. So yeah, and also there are some great things in the States as well, sort of around the QSA model, which is something that I think is really important and really exciting, came out of the GSA network in the States, which is the Gay Straight Alliance, rather than the QSA in New Zealand, which is the Queer Straight Alliance, which is great. Yeah. And probably most surprisingly to me was Tasmania seems to have really progressive and liberal education policies and community health policies, especially around sort of trans issues and things like that, which is surprised me, but which is really cool and like a model that New Zealand could take on, I think, in lots of ways. So, yeah.
It's interesting you mention about the GSA and QSA and the idea of labelling, and I'm wondering, you know, do you know why in the US it's called the Gay Straight Alliance and in New Zealand it's called the Queer Straight Alliance?
I'm not too sure. I think in New Zealand we've really claimed the idea of queerness and the queer identity and kind of rejected the word gay as an all-encompassing word, whereas maybe in the States they're still holding kind of onto that notion of gay representing the queer community, or what I would call the queer community. So I think it's just a difference in language use. But yeah, I think it would be quite strange for the QSA in its current model, which is very much queer, to kind of call itself the GSA. It would be very kind of strange, but yeah.
In your interviews around the country, what were the kind of words that people were using to either label themselves or people they worked with?
I think probably there's an interesting generational thing maybe going on, whereas where perhaps the older generation of people I were talking to would identify as gay and lesbian and sort of maybe use acronyms like LGBT, whereas the younger people I was talking to would just talk about being queer or queer people, queer and trans maybe, but yeah. But just use, yeah, queer or gender queer as their kind of all-encompassing terms. So I think there's an interesting generational shift there. And I think for all the older generation, queer is a really funny word that they don't like to associate with. Like, I know my parents really struggle with me using the word queer because they think it's quite a really negative word, whereas gay has got quite a positive kind of spin to it for them. Whereas for my generation, gay certainly has a very negative connotation in terms of high school culture, and so queer is less so, and I think queer has a more positive connotation. Yeah.
And I also have to apologise because at the front of this interview I said, oh, and you're gay, and I was completely making a whole range of assumptions, so I apologise.
No.
How would you identify yourself?
I still identify as gay, but I would say I'm gay. My gay identity fits within a queer community rather than fitting within, yeah, does that make sense? So queer being the kind of broader umbrella term, but my identity would still be gay, I suppose, yeah, if that makes sense.
What impact has your research had?
I hope that it's a valuable resource to people wanting to pursue change, but I don't know whether it's had too much impact just yet. There's still more sort of things we're hoping to pursue with it, which hopefully will have more impact. But yeah, I don't want it to be, I think there's a kind of a tendency with especially academic reports to kind of produce something and then to sort of talk about it for a little while and then for it to sort of be forgotten, or yeah, and I think that would be unfortunate because I think it'd be a waste of the people I was talking to, sort of a waste of their time and their voice, which I think is really valuable and I hope is kind of heard and represented well. So, yeah. So, for example, some of the things we'll be pursuing hopefully into the future is looking at ERA reporting in its current state and how effective or not effective it is by looking at policies around bullying and things like that, and hopefully presenting some kind of evidence about why there needs to be a change there, and hopefully getting some kind of change that would see actual policies and actual programs implemented into schools that would actually address homophobic bullying rather than just suggest that it's not an issue in their school and to tick a box kind of thing. Yeah,
I have a feeling that you're being a bit modest, because I was at a thing the other night where a member of parliament was very heavily referencing your research. What does that feel like for you to have a sitting MP referencing your work?
Yeah. yeah, that was pretty cool. I love Jan Logie. She's she's so beautiful. She's, yeah. Yeah, that was really amazing and very cool to think that it's serving kind of a purpose, or like something that can be useful or be referenceable for them. So yeah, kind of embarrassing too. Yeah.
So what next for Murray?
So hopefully we'll be able to pursue some more kind of research around schools and that sort of thing, but in the immediate future I'll be heading back to uni next year and doing master's project and yeah, carrying on with my studies. I really enjoy studying in university life, and so yeah.
What are the kind of areas that you'd be interested in maybe doing more research in?
I'm really interested in ideas about language and especially media and how you kind of frame the debate and how things are talked about and how ideas are constructed in kind of public discourse and public conversation. So I'd like to look at how we can kind of use that tool of language and framing issues to break down this silencing and sort of heteronormative structures that we see really apparent in our public discourse. I think so that would be something I'd love to look at more into. Yeah.
We're just coming to the end of the Marriage Equality Conference, which we've been attending over the last couple of days. How has that been for you?
It's been really cool, actually. I was kind of, when the marriage equality sort of movement started off, I kind of felt a bit funny about it. I kind of thought of all the issues for the queer community to sort of rally behind and kind of get active about, I kind of didn't think that marriage equality was the most important one. I would see just youth issues and bullying and silencing and those sorts of things as actually, and suicide is actually way more important than two people's right to get married, which is important for sure, but just, yeah, in the scheme of things, I wasn't sure it was the priority, but I think it's been really, really helpful and really important. Just, I've been really amazed at how the community has really got behind it and sort of kind of gone through this re-coming out process where they've all sort of, I've been amazed to see my friends who have really struggled to talk about their queerness in the past to kind of write submissions that are like incredibly powerful and just have me bawling my eyes out when I read them, just really sharing their story. And I think it's been really empowering for queer people to just come out and campaign behind this issue and to kind of come together. And in the process, I think it is breaking down all those issues around silence and heteronormativity, because we're kind of challenging that kind of marginalization by talking about this issue and pursuing it and saying that this is that we, you know, we want equality, that's kind of our right as citizens. And so, yeah, I think it's been like, it's been a it's given like huge energy and growth to the community, even though it's probably not something I initially expected to be really important or really powerful. I think it definitely has been.